Pozcast. Thank you for having me, Joe.
Hi, welcome to the Pozcast. I am Joe Poznanski, and with me is Michael Shore. Michael, welcome.
Joe, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. You're welcome. How are you feeling this week? How are you?
You're asking because you know for a fact that I'm sad because there's no baseball.
There's no baseball. And you know, when we go into this program for us to record this, we get to put our name in, and you always put your name in as usually as some sort of celebrity or baseball fan or something of the news. But just it's just sad Mike this week. That's all it is.
Yeah, sad Mike. Yep. I mean, especially at a time, as we've discussed, when we are both kind of out on the NFL.
Yeah.
Usually, like, you're sad for like a week when baseball season ends. And then you're like, but look, it's November. The NFL action is heating up. But since I'm not following the NFL this year in any meaningful way, that is out. Now, I will say that I'm kind of all in on the NBA. I don't know. Have we talked about this or not? I can't remember whether
we have a little bit, but yes.
Yeah. Like I have decided that I'm back on the NBA bandwagon hard. Like I took my whole family. We brought a picnic lunch and we are riding the NBA bandwagon. And I watched for the first time. I can't remember the last year that I watched a complete NBA game before, you know, March.
Right.
I would say.
Right.
And I watched a full Celtics game the other day. I watched the full Celtics-Lakers game. I watched the full Celtics game before that. This Celtics team is so fun. I mean, I couldn't be jumping back on the NBA bandwagon at a better time, frankly, because the Celtics are so fun to watch. Jason Tatum, after like 12 games, appears to be like already like a B-plus NBA player, which is crazy. He's averaging like 20-9 a game. And then Kyrie is like unshackled from playing second fiddle to LeBron, and he's like going out of his mind. They're a super fun team to watch. And then also just everywhere, when you watch the NBA now, you go to the menu. I got League Pass, and you go to the menu and you're like, what? Oh my God, there's 14 other games.
I know.
And they're all good.
They're
like
all
there's
good.
Like Oklahoma City, Minnesota is a great game. Like you want to, there's five guys in that game you want to watch play. So that the only thing keeping me from being like super down in the dumps, Mike, because a baseball season ending is my newfound bandwagon jumping love for the NBA.
You know, I gotta say, I'm with you. I'm totally into the NBA this year, and I'll tell you what it is. You know, for the last 4 or 5 years, obviously, you know, as a Cleveland fan, that's been incredible with LeBron coming home. As sort of a fan of just wonderful things. That Golden State team, you know, the way they sort of emerged on the scene, and I love Steph, and I've loved Steph Curry since Davidson days, and whatever, that's been really fun. But it feels like this year the NBA has gone to a whole new level because I never would have expected this. I'm totally into that Houston team. I'm totally
interested.
Yeah, and it was something I would never, you know, I'm sort of pseudo friends with Daryl Morey, which is fun and nice, and so I kind of want it for him, but there was nothing about that team that I particularly liked. But now, you know, even though Chris Paul hasn't played, they have Chris Paul. James Harden seems to be taking it to a whole other level. Did you see that the other day? He's scored or assisted on like 94 points in the game.
It was insane. It's some kind of crazy number.
Yeah, it's second literally to Wilt for the Wilt's 100. Right. It's like this is second on the list. So he's gone like to a whole other level. They're kind of fun. I mean, Eric Gordon is kind of fun. I mean, he is kind of fun. Yeah, I'm telling you. Suddenly, I'm watching that team because that team seemed to be perfectly set to be like the anti-Warrior team, like the team that, you know, that sort of trying to defeat whatever the Warriors represent or whatever. I don't know now. I don't know that they're. I don't know which side is the Empire and which side is the Resistance. I mean, they're both great in their own way. It's fun when there are like lots and lots of cool things to look at, which is, I think, way NBA is right now.
Yeah, it is. I think it's, I hope it sustains itself in terms of my own personal, just selfishly. I hope that like my interest doesn't wane. But I am finding it so far incredibly fun. And weirdly, the East, you would expect the West to be fun, but I'm finding the East to be pretty fun. I think the Celtics is fun. The Cavaliers struggling is fun in some weird way. Like, can they figure it out? Can they put it together?
No, that's right.
Watching Giannis Antetokounmpo is like a religious experience, watching him play basketball.
It's so fun.
I believe his hands are 12 inches from his heel to the tip of his middle finger. Have you heard that?
I think that's right.
Yeah, I think it's a full foot. So he's just like, he's just absurd. He's an absurd person, and I love watching him.
You know what's amazing about him? I want to say one thing about him. There was the play, and I think so far sort of been the NBA play of the year, where he came flying in and blocked a shot like in some insane way. And then the break came, and he filled the lane on the break and dunked from like the free throw line or something. It's so amazing to think that physically, we're not even talking about, you know, what their skill levels are. When we first saw Michael Jordan play in the NBA, it was like, what is this? You know, I mean, even though we'd seen Dr. J and there had been other players that had done this, he took it like to a whole other level. It's like, oh my gosh, athletically, I'd never seen anybody who could fly and do all the things that he does in the air. And I mean, this is like a whole new thing. And like, that's like four generation. That's like iPhone 1, you know?
Right.
I mean, when you look at what they can do athletically now, it's insane. It's so insane.
Yes. Which goes back to the other point it's worth making, which is that anytime anyone for any reason says anything about like Bob Cousy or, you know, or even like Jerry West or these guys. And then you go back and look at them and they're just like very casually running around in circles, dribbling the ball. The ball is coming up to their waist and they're just sort of running around. And you think like you could probably take a Celtics or Lakers or any championship team from like the late 50s or 60s and put them up against just like LeBron and
four guys.
Yeah, like Marcus Smart and LeBron and like, Jamal Crawford. Just those three guys would beat any 50s or 60s NBA championship team by 40. Like after three quarters, one of those three guys would be sitting on the bench just to give him some rest because they don't need him.
You know, it's funny. Look, I have tremendous. I'm a sports history guy. It's what I am, and I have tremendous respect for what those guys were because it was a different time. It was different things that they were figuring out. Things
sure.
that Bob Cousy was figuring out. Nobody had ever done before. So he was a man of his time. He was incredible in his time. If he played today, he wouldn't be that player. So it's not a fair comparison.
Right, right.
That said, the guy couldn't dribble with his left hand. I mean, Bob Cousy, the greatest ball handler of his time, if he had to go left, he would do like a 360, like spin around the other way because he couldn't dribble with his left hand. I mean, that doesn't seem like...
No, you know, and then you watch what Kyrie Irving does every day in the realm of, quote, dribbling, end quote, and you realize how far the game has progressed. It's just the nature of things. It's like anything else. It's like, any person in any field from a long time ago, from 10 generations ago, is not going to be as good as people now. But that doesn't mean they weren't great then. It doesn't mean they don't deserve to be in Hall of Fame, blah, 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 blah. It's a boring argument, I know, but it is also fun. It's like the thing that I tweet every year. On the day that an NFL team, the last undefeated NFL team, I always tweet some version of the same thing, which is congrats to the 1972 Dolphins. This year's Cleveland Browns would have beaten you by 85 points. They had offensive linemen who weighed like 270 pounds or something. Like it wouldn't have been anywhere close to a competitive game.
By the way, that should just be our Browns update this week. The Browns. The Browns had a bye. So our update should be that they still would have. They'd beat the 72 Dolphins.
They would absolutely. The 0-8 Cleveland Browns would easily beat the 1972 Dolphins.
Well,
I mean, easily.
Offensive linemen were like 240 pounds. I mean,
They ran Larry Zonka 48 times a game. Like that was what football was. So,
yeah. By the way, the fact that you could run Larry Zonka 45 times tells you it's not the same game. right? Because, right. I mean, he'd be hurt on the third play, and that nothing against Larry Zonka. But, I mean, nobody can run the ball 45 times now against these defenses is with the way they play. I mean, I assume, again, we're not following the NFL that closely. I assume that somebody got hurt in the Thursday night game, and then I woke up this morning and saw, oh, Richard Sherman. Okay, well, yes, sure.
Arguably the biggest star besides Tom Brady left who hadn't gotten hurt got hurt.
Exactly. Yeah.
The most famous person except for Tom Brady in the league who still has not gotten hurt is now hurt.
Okay, there you go. Enjoy the NFL. All right, so I want to read something to you. I want to read you something, but I want you to sort of put yourself in this mindset. You've been in a coma for like the last, not even that long, last 5 years. You don't have to go back really, really far.
By the way, before I know what this is, that right now at this moment, that sounds kind of great. To have been in a coma since 2012.
You're 2012. You're like, yeah, well, what's wrong? The world's great. You don't want to get out.
I'm going to take 5 years off. I'm going to go into a medically induced coma and just chill for 5 years. And I'm sure when I come out, everything will still be fine.
Everything will be fine. You just come in and you're like, oh, so what's it like with Hillary as president? No, I have bad news. But okay, so you're in the coma for 5 years and you get out, and the first thing you do is like, you're vaguely aware of what Twitter is. So the first thing you do is you open up your Twitter account, of course. Sure. You're like, hey, let me catch up. And this is the first thing you hear, and I want to hear what your reaction would be. This is the first thing you read. Papa John's pleads for Nazis to not buy their pizza after getting embraced by Daily Stormer.
Okay, the first thing I do is I go right back into the medically induced coma for another 5 years. Because what I discern from that is that something has gone terribly wrong and I don't want any part of it. And I don't want to know what it is. And I want to go back. I want to go to sleep for five more years.
It's like, I'm not done yet. I'm not ready.
That is where we are. That's exactly. I would say if you needed to like create a sort of like spiritual, emotional GPS for the state of America in 2017, that is the "you are here" of that situation. If you're looking at a map of where we are and where what our surroundings are, the little thing that says "you are here" is pointing to a tweet that tells you that Papa John's Pizza has had to ask Nazis to stop endorsing it. That's it. That's where we are. That's the exact center. That's the epicenter of where we are right now.
I have tried in my mind to untangle the wonderment of that tweet because you have to go down so many roads to get there. Like if you did, by the way, somebody told me that I use literally way too much on this podcast, which I'm sure I do. So if you could keep an eye out for the
literally use it like 3,000 times per podcast.
I literally do. It's true. You're reading this tweet, so the first thing that has to come to mind is, okay, wait a minute, Nazis are buying pizza, right? Like that's the first thing, right? When you're untangling this,
mm-hmm. the first thing you say is not just they're buying pizza; they have a favorite pizza.
They have a favorite pizza,
the official pizza of Nazis. Yeah.
Well, actually, your first thing is what Nazis are back. That has to be your first thought. Right,
you got to back up. If you've been in the coma for 5 years, you go, wait, I'm sorry, what now? Nazis? Okay,
Nazis.
Nazis are here, and they are. It's casual enough to talk about their doings that we've gotten to the point where we know what their favorite pizza is. Yeah, that's where you have to start. Yeah.
And so then you go, well, what could Papa John have done to even get them to buy their pizza? Because Papa John's pizza is horrific. It's
now, horrendous. I would immediately make the leap to it involves the NFL, personally. I'm not kidding. Because the only thing you know about, it's one of two things. It has to do with Peyton Manning or the NFL, right? Those are the two things.
That's right. Because the only thing you know about him. That's right.
So I would immediately guess, based on the interests of Nazis and based on Papa John's affiliation with the NFL, I would say, okay, this has something to do with the African-American community in regards to the NFL. So I don't think that's a hard leap.
I think I'd get like he wore a swastika during one of those commercials. Like
accidentally.
Like it was like a little pin. He didn't mean to wear it, but it was like they forgot to take it off. I mean, I don't know that I would jump to the like to something with African Americans in the NFL because that wouldn't be my first thought on Nazis.
Okay.
Like that wouldn't So my first thought on Nazis would be, you know, something, he did something with a swastika or some Indiana Jones thing. He came out and said, you know, I actually was rooting against Indiana Jones or something, you know, and, but then why is he pleading for them not to do it? Like, what did he do that brought them in?
I have to say that Papa John 100% brought this on himself. And I Papa John's pizza personally is not my taste. I find it to be.
No, it's not.
But he 100% brought this on himself because he came out and said the protests for the social justice protests that are taking place during the national anthem of football games are hurting his sales. Now, this is as a great philosopher once wrote, nonsense on stilts. That's absurd. That there's literally no way that's true. I think it's far more likely that his sales are being hurt by the fact that his pizza stinks. but regardless, he didn't have, even if that's true, he did not have to come out publicly and say that, right? He did that. Right. He wanted to get on his high horse and he wanted to make a stink in the same way that the people making a stink about social justice were making a stink, except his cause, instead of social justice and equality, was my pizza sales. So instead of members of the NFL Players Association saying, we are going to do a silent, quiet, polite protest during the national anthem before our games to point out what we feel are systemic racial injustices that are baked into the very fabric of the country in which we live, he decided to do a similar thing, except he was like, all of these protests are hurting my pizza sales. At which point, Nazis gonna Nazi, right? So they were like, oh, great, here we go. This guy's on our team because he's...
We finally have our guy.
He's dog whistling at us and saying like, hey, Nazis, come over here and get my back. And they were like, you got it, buddy. We're behind you, Papa John. And then he had to go like, whoa, wait a second. I didn't want Nazis to buy my pizza, because Nazis buying your pizza is a whole lot worse than a 3% quarter over quarter dip in sales or whatever it was. And so I have zero, I mean, and I can't emphasize this enough, zero sympathy for Papa John.
Oh, yeah.
It's so funny to watch someone who is purports to be good at business blow something so severely as it relates to business. I mean, you know, you've mentioned many times you are available to be to give advice to politicians of party, of any party, in terms of how they relate to or how they deal with sports, how they talk about sports while they're campaigning, just to avoid the general embarrassment of saying the wrong thing, saying something stupid, whatever. You have made yourself available in that service. I likewise would like to offer my services to anyone, business owners or politicians, anyone who wants to know whether something they say is going to get them in trouble with Nazis. if you had come to me and said like, hey, I want to say this thing about my pizza, I would have been like, okay, man, just so you know, there's lots of Nazis around right now and they are psyched to get on board with anything that smacks of racism or a sort of like pro-white, anti-non-white agenda. So if you say this, a bunch of Nazis are going to come out and post on a bunch of Nazi message boards that Papa John's is the official pizza of Nazis. And if you were cool with that, go ahead. But that is what is going to happen. And I feel like maybe at that point, Papa John would have said, okay, I maybe won't do that.
I'm just imagining you in a truck with like the word Nazi on the back, but with a line through it.
Like
that's your job. Like that's your logo.
I'm going to go drive around. And if you want to avoid Nazis as a business, as an individual, as a politician, whatever, if your goal is to avoid association with Nazis, I can help.
I also imagined him giving at some point, Papa John giving some sort of TED talk about how he built Papa John's up into a thing. And he's talking about whatever it is and the fresh ingredients thing. And I thought tying myself with the NFL and then getting to that stage in the TED talk where he goes, now I did have this time where
there was
Nazis
one moment where I accidentally got a bunch of Nazis to support me.
I can't get enough.
It's wonderful. There's a lot of wonderful stuff happening around the NFL right now. And by wonderful, of course, I mean moron stepping in it. That's how I define wonderful. The other thing being, as we were texting about this, is Jerry Jones potentially, we don't know who, no one really knows the details on this, but the story is Jerry Jones is potentially going to sue his own league because Roger Goodell is getting a contract extension that he doesn't think is appropriate. And then there's the second level of that story, which already, by the way, I mean, this is like, this is heaven. This is, to me, this is manna from heaven. But the second level of the story may be even better in a subtle way, which is that apparently the thing that Roger Goodell is upset about is that Jerry Jones, I guess, wants his money to be non-guaranteed. He wants there to be incentives baked into the contract. So just to get this straight, the That's sport right. that uses up players and disposes of them like tissue and is the only major sport really where the contract is not in any way guaranteed, where you can blow out your knee, you can have a what is on paper $100 million contract, blow out your knee, get paid like $3 million, and you never play football again.
Right.
That sport where those players are that disposable, and the players' union is coming, there's going to be a reckoning because the game is so violent and the people get hurt so much, and all the contracts are non-guaranteed. The commissioner, who by most accounts has made well north of $200 million. In salary and bonuses since 2006, that guy is now furious that his contract might not be fully guaranteed. I just can't. I just want. I saw that and I put my fingertips to my lips in the classic like Italian chef gesture, and I kissed them and threw the kisses into the air just for like an hour. It couldn't be better. Both aspects of that story could not be better for my money.
Well, and we have to add that because the point that I think you I think the point that was sort of the crescendo because that obviously the guaranteed contracts thing is very, very good stuff, but wasn't the crescendo of this thing when they started talking about subpoenaing their phone records?
Yes. Of owners. Oh my God, you're right. That's even better that the owners, including Jerry Jones and others, might have to submit their phones. And I mean, that's amazing because you know what would happen if they did. They would take their phones and smash them with hammers, right? That's absolutely what they would do.
They should. I mean, there's no question they don't want those phones to be subpoenaed at any point for anybody for any reason.
Couldn't be better.
It's unbelievable. I mean, it really is. No, it's absolutely incredible. Several people have wondered, and I think it is a fair question. What does this mean for Goodell as commissioner?
He has a lifetime contract here. He has a. I don't know.
Why did we give him that?
He has a lifetime
that?
Contract. It's $35 million a year guaranteed every year for as long as
it is guaranteed.
It renews every year, but it's his option. So I feel like he's going to keep opting in.
He'll keep doing that. I remember when we signed the deal to guarantee his contract. I mean, like, you know, because at the time there were a lot of other options for him and we had to do it. I don't remember.
Yeah, it's
I don't
a lifetime deal.
A lifetime
well, what happened
contract.
Was we were unsure whether we wanted to make it a lifetime deal, and then he promised us that he would bring law and order back to the podcast, and then we were like, "Well, that's a great pitch," and
so
we signed up for that.
That's right. I forgot about that. Well, you know, he's right. He's right. this podcast has been lawless and orderless for way too long. All right. Let's get to our main topic of the day before we get to listener questions. The awards, baseball
That's
awards.
True.
We got baseball to talk about, sort
yeah,
of.
We got baseball.
Sort of, right? Sort of, yeah. All right, we got baseball awards coming up. And
sure.
They're fun. They're fun. So we're just going to kind of go through the awards and sort of make our picks, and then we'll go on to listener questions. So let's start out with the first one that is going to come out, which is going to be Manager of the Year, which I think both of us have discussed on the podcast. Not a great award.
Well,
really,
here's the thing with Manager of the Year. It's like it doesn't ever go to the actual person it should go to, right? It usually just goes to the person who won the most games or something. But what –
Well, right, one of the most games,
the
over
biggest
the year
like
before,
improvement.
Right? It's always the team.
Whereas what it should most. Probably be right, right. The person you should probably just say like, well, who did the best job of managing in terms of like holding a team together or of cobbling together a lineup or of dealing with adversity in some way, injuries or whatever. Like it just basically goes to like, oh, the Brewers won 71 games last year and this year they won 86 games. And so we'll give it to the manager of the Brewers. That's generally speaking what happens.
Right. And which is kind of a disaster because
right.
the next year they stink because, you know, that's just the way that works. I mean, that's the Bill James, you know, plexiglass theory anyway, that everything sort of comes back to the middle. And then the guy gets fired. I mean, the number of manager of the years who were fired within 3 years or 2 years of winning the award is pretty staggering. And there's another part of it that I don't like now. And this is something I harp on probably too much, but it's something I really believe about baseball that we miss.
Yeah,
it's not a regular season sport anymore. It's just not what it is. You know, I mean, yes, the regular season is still the joy of baseball and it's still the heart of what fans get to do. But it's all what you do in the postseason. That's where the game has gone. And so you can give like, you know, the nominees for the National League mm-hmm. are
right.
Dave Roberts for the Dodgers, of course, Corey Lovullo for Arizona and Bud Black for Colorado. Well, Bud Black, you know, I think Bud Black did a fine job, but
yeah,
Colorado didn't make the postseason. So it's like, I mean, they made it the one wild card game, but it's like, all right, whatever. And you know, they really weren't a factor. And even Lovullo and, you know, that Arizona team kind of disappointed in that series against the Dodgers, didn't win a game. And Dave Roberts goes to the World Series. So now you look at it and go, well, you know, look, however you feel about it, Dave Roberts is the guy that guided his team the furthest or whatever. But that's not what the voting is on. The voting is on how they did in the regular season. You know, it just seems yeah. like an award a little bit out of time. But and it is an award.
I mean, it's
so
important.
All those three.
I would say, so look, Mike Hazen's the GM of those three Diamondbacks. And if there were, if there's an Executive of the Year award, right. I feel like he should get it because that team turned over sure. a lot of guys and they reconceived the team. And then he traded for JD Martinez halfway through the year, which is the best, obviously the best mid-season trade probably, right? It's that or Verlander.
Incredible. So, oh,
Verlander, yeah, I do too. But in terms of actual manager of the year, it's hard to know what any of these guys actually do, right? Like Torrey Lovullo is very well liked and he was a candidate for the Red Sox job before he went to Arizona and everyone seems to really like him, but it's gotta be Dave Roberts. And it's not Dave Roberts because they won the most games to me. It's Dave Roberts because they lost 15 out of 16 out of nowhere in the middle of the year. And there's an amazing stat, which is only one team I think had ever lost 15 out of 16 at any point in the season and finished with a winning record. And the Dodgers lost 15 out of 16.
Right. Right.
And won their division, won the best division of baseball easily, and went to the World Series and then went to the seventh game. So, like, something weird happened to that team for 2.5 weeks or 3 weeks. They went into a crazy tailspin, and he or they, obviously it's they, pulled out of it and went on to like win the division and then went deep in the playoffs. It did not, they didn't have a hangover from that weird, weird 3 week stretch where they suddenly couldn't beat anyone. And I don't know what managers do really. But whatever they do, he did it really well because he pulled them out of that.
Yeah.
To me, that's like anecdotally, which is the only way that people like you and me can really evaluate anything a manager does. It's from an extreme distance, anecdotally from afar. That's got to earn him the Manager of the Year award.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, that Dodgers team, every team goes through a lot of stuff. But that Dodgers team definitely did. There was, you know, there were some injuries. There was how to deal with the whole Adrian Gonzalez situation. You know, how quickly to jump on the Cody Bellinger thing. You know, I mean, when they brought him up, I don't think they necessarily knew that he was going to be up all year and become sort of the heart of their lineup and all that. But he adjusted to that. They kept throwing veterans at him. That's never easy, especially, you know, veterans like Curtis Granderson and Chase Utley, who are not the players they once were. I mean, these are all challenges, and every team deals with them. But he seemed to deal with it well. The irony to me is I really think, and I've thought this for a while, I thought Dusty Baker did a heck of a job
yeah.
in Washington.
Yeah,
really
you're not
did.
Wrong.
you know, and I thought they dealt with a lot of stuff. That bullpen was a disaster. I mean, like legendary disaster when the season began. And they worked through it and they won the division easily. And, you know, really we can't even talk about postseason, but a bad game five where a couple of bad things went wrong. Otherwise they're the ones going on.
Yep.
So, you know, again, tough to say. I like Dave Roberts, the American League. You got Terry Francona, AJ Hinch and Paul Molitor. Again, you know, I think Francona is the best manager in baseball. I think he's the best. I think he's the best every year, basically.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can't give it to him every year. I think he won it last year. I'm not even 100% sure of that. I think he won it last year. And, you know, so I'd give it to Hinch. I don't, neither one of those guys, AJ Hinch or Dave Roberts, or really any of these guys, I mean, Torey Lovullo, the same thing. There are a lot of times that they make moves that you go, boy, I don't get that. I don't get that at all.
Yeah.
But that's not really what it is. That's the manager of the year, especially if you're dealing with just the regular season, is who's getting you through the season, who is dealing with the issues and problems of the team best. You know, AJ Hinch, Houston also got off to a hot start, went through a middle struggle and came out on the other end, right?
Yeah, and Molitor's probably going to win it, frankly, because the Twins lost 100 games and then went to the playoffs, and that had never happened before. Like, I feel like Molitor's going to win it. But Hinch deserves it. I mean, Terry Francona also deserves it. They're all the manager of the year. But I got to say, Hinch, not that this counts, but Hinch really impressed me in the playoffs. I felt like he was incredibly even keeled, I thought, giving press conferences after those insane games. I mean, Roberts was too, but Hinch was really chill. And I felt like, oh, I get it. I kind of get how you have a team with a bunch of really young superstars, like really young, like 23, 24, 25, and not a lot of starting pitching and a shaky bullpen, and you turn that team into a 100 and whatever it was win team. You do it with a manager like this who's just super chill and really calm and like I mean this is, it's so pointless. It's like, you can, any of these guys should win it, could win it, will win it. It doesn't really matter. My guess is Molitor is going to be the guy who wins it, but I personally would vote for Hinch.
Yeah, I think Hinch is going to win it. I mean, we'll see on Molitor, you know, you're right. I think all those guys did a good job. That's Tuesday at 6 p.m., by the way, on MLB Network, if you want to see that one.
Rookie of the Year. House, like a huge party, like 500 people. I do every year for Manager of the Year unveiling. It's a big blowout, like 500 people.
They're never invited.
You never know. Well, it's really only locals, and you're not local, but we dance all night. We have a DJ. There's like tons of booze and just like fun. And it's like, to me, Manager of the Year is the biggest day of the year, I would say. The Manager of the Year really
like is. You have to say this. Everybody's heard of the Shore Manager of the Year party, right? I mean, it's only the biggest thing in Hollywood. So you don't need to brag about it. We know. It's a great deal. Rookie of the Year is Monday at 6 p.m. on MLB Network. We know who's going to win those, but I'll just give you the candidates. The National League, it's Josh Bell, who actually had a really good year, by the way. Paul DeJong, and then Cody Bellinger, who's going to win it. In the National League, Trey Mancini, Andrew Benintendi, who actually was the preseason, everybody thought he was going to win the award guy. And Aaron Judge, who's obviously going to win it. Anything you have to add on Rookie of the Year? We know who's going to win.
Only that Benintendi deserves it over Judge. Obviously, I mean, Judge is going to win. He's the flashy choice, but Benintendi deserves it. His numbers are better. It took a lot of talent and guts to hit way fewer home runs than Aaron Judge and to have a way worse.
He held himself back for
the good of the team, and he won't get any credit for that. But, you know, but he deserves it. And Judge is like, yeah, I get it. Whatever. He's tall and he's whatever. He plays for the Yankees. But everybody secretly knows that Benintendi deserves it.
Sure. Well, that's a given. Yeah. It's just the way, you know,
it's just the way things go, you know.
It's the way things go. New York media. That's what it is. That's what it's
East
all
Coast
about.
Bias.
East Coast bias. Really East Coast.
That's right.
Really. But no, actually, sort of East Coast. All right. Cy Young awards are going to be November 15th at 6 p.m. on MLB Network. I guess that's Wednesday. Your nominees in the National League are Clayton Kershaw, Max Scherzer, and Steven Strasburg. Fascinating. Actually a fascinating award. Sort of fascinating in the American League with Corey Kluber, Chris Sale, and Luis Severino. By the way, do you like them bringing it down to three candidates?
I kind of do and kind of don't. Like, everybody always knows basically who like the three finalists are anyway. But I kind of do like it because you curtail a certain amount of blowhardiness with people. If they didn't bring it down to those three, there would be a certain number of people who would be saying the real Cy Young Award winner is Craig Kimbrell. Like, he's the real, you know, there would be like, there would be all these dumb, pointless things. And so it's, I think it's good to sort of narrow it down to the three guys that you know should be the three guys.
Yeah.
I was a little bit surprised to see Severino, though, I got to say.
I was too. I really was seeing Severino in there. Look, and he had a great year, but I was a little surprised. It just kind of felt like there were, it was Kluber and Sale and then a lot of other guys, like five or six other guys. And they just picked Severino as one of those other guys. He's not, he's obviously not going to win it, but it's an honor to be nominated. I think that's, I think that's what all these guys think.
Sure.
I think it's going to be Kluber and Kershaw. That's my prediction of what it's going to be. What do you think?
I think that you're right. I think the Strasburg and Scherzer split the vote a little bit. I also think that Sale had it locked up on or around August 1st and then faded a little bit and specifically faded. I mean, he had 300 strikeouts, which is great.
Oh, he was fantastic.
He was dominant all year. He had 300 strikeouts. The problem is he not only faded a little bit, he faded against the Indians. That was part of the problem is that these big games when it was like ever the attention of the nation was on the game. It was, this is a potential ALCS preview, blah, 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 blah. He fell apart. Like the Indians just beat the crap out of him to the point where whenever that happens where the guy is good as Sale, you assume that it's because he was tipping his pitches. Somehow they crack the code because that you can't do that to Chris Sale if you don't know what's coming. You really can't. There's no way to do it. His slider is too dominant and his fastball is too good and his command is too good. And it was like they would just sit on fastball. It was a little bit like Kershaw in the World Series in that second game. It was like they just like were like it was Gurriel hit that like 7,000 foot home run. And it's like he knew what was coming. There's no other explanation. Yeah. I mean, the other explanation obviously would be these guys are really good hitters, but
well, they are. Well, and also, I mean, I did hear that Sale wore down and was hurt a little bit. I mean, that's all possible. But I think tipping pitches is a big deal. I want to talk for 1 second about the National League because you could make a pretty good argument that Scherzer deserves the award over Kershaw. I mean, you know, I mean, and obviously you can make that argument all the time. You can make that argument Strasburg deserves it more, but you can make a good argument that Scherzer is kind of being pretty wildly underrated this year. I mean, he had a fantastic season. He had the full season. He pitched in more starts. Obviously Kershaw got hurt a little bit. But you're talking about a guy who led the league with a 0.902 whip, which is insane.
Yes.
Led the league in strikeouts, gave up no hits, basically no hits, gave up 5.7 hits per nine. You could make a pretty strong argument pitching in the park where he pitches and all of that, that, that he really deserves it over Kershaw.
Yeah.
But I think Kershaw's going to win it. I really do.
Yeah. And by the way, you can also make an argument for Kershaw over Scherzer. Like,
it
goes both ways. It's like Kershaw was the ERA champion. He led the league in wins. He struck out seven guys for every guy he walked. He had the highest ERA plus of any pitcher, which is adjusted for the park he plays in. Scherzer was the strikeout king. He was the whip king. I think he was the wins above replacement king because Kershaw was injured and missed a month. I mean, this is why awards are stupid, right? It's like you give it to Scherzer, all of Kershaw's fans will say that's absurd. You give it to Kershaw, all of Kershaw's fans will say that's absurd. Both groups of people will be right. It is absurd. I would be happy if they split it. They should probably split it. That won't happen. I feel like the guy who Kershaw, it's just impossible to make an argument against either of them. The only argument you can make against Kershaw is that he was injured for a little while and missed some starts, but he's still at the league. So it's like, well, what does that mean now? It's like, anyone. I mean, the best argument in my mind for Scherzer is what you just said. He's unhittable. You cannot get a hit off.
He's unhittable.
I saw a stat where his batting average, the third or later time through the lineup, his batting average against was 168. So the third and fourth times that guys see him in a game, they hit 168 off him. I mean, that's ridiculous. And I'm sure that the other guys' batting averages against are whatever, 240 or something. It's not like they get raked with the third or fourth time through. But 168 is like, that's the greatest relief pitchers in the league in the ninth against anyone.
Right.
He's doing that against every hitter the third or fourth time they see him in a game.
The third or fourth time through. Yeah. That's insane. He's so
good. Yeah, he's wonderful.
He's so good. All right, well, we'll see that one. That's going to be fun to watch, you know, but you're right. I think that's going to be defined by who loses it, because they
now, again, manager of the year, I have a huge blowout. For Cy Young Award, I do a much smaller thing. It's a cocktail thing. It's like casual dress. It's a very small group of people. It's like 40 to 45 people, mostly just, you know, leaders in their fields, scientists, researchers, literary types. It's more of a salon feeling, I would say.
I believe I have been invited to that.
You have been invited to that, yes. And there's a lot of there's a string quartet that I hire, and they play some chamber music, and it's very sort of refined and genteel. That's what I do for the Cy Young Awards,
Obviously, it's very different. It's very different than manager.
Different vibe, different award, different vibe, different people. There's also a Cy Young Award announcement lecture series I do, where I invite one person to come and just sort of give a lecture on anything. It could be, you know, Renaissance literature. It could be, you know, 19th century biology breakthroughs, whatever. Expert in the field comes and, yeah.
Yeah. Didn't you, for the year I was invited, you invited Lin-Manuel Miranda to just speak about, not even about specifically music. You wanted him to talk a little bit about the Founding Fathers.
It was the Founding Fathers, that it was Latin American influence in musical theater, just in general, not just Hamilton, but just, you know, the sort of taking us to the history of the Latin American influence.
It was beautiful.
You know, it was great. Yeah. And then at the end of it, we sort of all gather around the TV and we watch the Cy Youngs be presented.
Very different than the sort of the Caligula like
the crazy sort of orgiastic blowout of the Manager of the Year Awards. Yeah.
The MVP award, nobody cares about. Obviously, it's the least significant of the awards, but they're still going to have it next Thursday, 6 p.m. on MLB Network. Your National League nominees, Paul Goldschmidt of Arizona, Giancarlo Stanton of Miami, and Joey Votto. Was awesome to see Joey. He has no chance, none, zero.
Zero chance. That's correct.
But so great to see him nominated. He, by the way, did not win the Silver Slugger Award again. He's never won a Silver Slugger Award.
He's never won it?
He's never won a Silver Slugger Award.
He's the best hitter, though.
He just keeps getting beat by, you know, he did happen to come along at a time where Pujols took him out the first bunch of times, and now Goldschmidt took him out, you know. So, I mean, they're always really good hitting first baseman. But at this point, I don't even care about the Silver Slugger Award per se, but he's got to win one of these years. I mean,
that is hilarious. I did not know that. He's never he's going to go to the Hall of Fame without ever winning a Silver Slugger Award.
Never the best hitting first baseman. I mean, that's just very
in his league, by the way, not in all of.
He's won the MVP and he's never won a Silver Slugger Award. All right, the American League is Jose Altuve, Aaron Judge, and Jose Ramirez. Again, great to see Jose Ramirez in there. He has no chance.
Nope.
So realistically, National League, Goldschmidt or Stanton, who's going to win it and who should win it?
I think Stanton's going to win.
I do too.
I don't know. Should he win? I don't know. I mean, he has a significant lead in wins above replacement over Goldschmidt. He almost hit 60 home runs. It was a fun story. Like, he became the story of the second half, at least in the National League, you would say. I don't know how you don't give it to him unless you care about whether his team made the playoffs, which I don't.
No, me.
I mean, Goldschmidt is such a good hitter. Goldschmidt is so fun to watch. He's such a good hitter. He does some things, I would say, that Stanton doesn't do. He steals bases.
Right.
He has 18 stolen bases, which is kind of shocking. I mean, they both walk a ton. Goldschmidt walks a little more. Goldschmidt, I think, is a better defender. I mean, should either of them win it? Who cares? It's a dumb thing to talk about. Yes, they should both win it. I think Stanton's going to win it. And I think it's cool that if Stanton wins it, I think it's cool.
I do too. And I think Stanton will win it. And I would vote for him. The thing about Goldschmidt is, I love him. I never want to say a single negative thing about Goldschmidt. He's the greatest. He's every single thing you want in a player is Paul Goldschmidt. But he kind of had this thing in his hands, and then Stanton went crazy, and then Goldschmidt kind of had like a medium finish to the year, right? He didn't, you know, not that should matter. None of it should matter. You should be able to look at the full season and whatever, but it's like, you know, that's people start paying attention to that stuff in September, and Paul Goldschmidt never really had. In fact, he came in to the postseason with like 0 for 20 or something, right? Didn't he have some crazy hitless streak that he broke? He broke right away by hitting a home run against Colorado. But yeah, so I think it's going to be Stanton, and I think I'd probably vote for Stanton, but I think your point is right. I mean, plus Joey Votto is arguably better than both of them.
That's correct. And yes, you know, he had a better year than both of them.
And he has no chance. So, you know.
It's the Tommy Pham update.
The real MVP we all know in the National League is Tommy Pham. Congrats to Tommy Pham.
Obviously. By the way, have you seen the video that is going around of Tommy Pham on the treadmill? Where the treadmill is like, oh, you've got to see it. It's on Twitter. It's him doing some sort of speed drill. So he's on a treadmill, like standing on the sides with his feet not on it. And the treadmill is going like super duper fast, like 100 miles an hour. I don't even know how fast it's going, but it's super, super fast. And he like puts his foot down once and puts his foot down twice and then jumps on it and like spritzes his heart out for like 10 seconds and then jumps off.
That seems dangerous.
I wanted you to see it because my question to you for the Tommy Pham update was going to be, what would happen if we were the ones on the thing? I mean, we would like fly back like 7 miles, right? It would be like some superhero thing. So anyway, Tommy Pham, obviously the MVP of the podcast. I think Altuve is going to win it in the American League, but boy, Aaron Judge he really made a strong push at the end.
Yeah, I hope Altuve wins it. I kind of imagine that Judge might, because Judge was such a story, and you know, you can give it to Judge. There's an obvious argument for Judge. But the fun thing about Altuve, besides the fact that he's 2.5 feet tall, and he lives inside a teacup, and his best friend is a mouse who wears a mouse monocle, is that he does everything. That's the thing he has over Judge, right? Yeah, he does everything. Yeah. Now, Judge is a much better defensive right fielder than you would ever imagine a man his size should be. But Altuve led the league in hits again. He had 39 doubles, which was 15 more than Judge. He stole 32 bases. He only struck out 84 times, which in this day and age is shocking. He plays incredibly good defensive second base. There's no aspect of his game that is lacking. There really isn't. Like he's the toughest out in the best lineup by far, and he's just insanely consistent. He's the engine of that offense, and it's not like a great underdog story in the way that like people used to say David Eckstein was a great underdog story or Rudy is a great underdog story. It's like Rudy, except Rudy is like the best middle linebacker in the country. And leads all of college football in sacks, and they win a national championship because of Rudy.
Rudy.
You know what I mean? It's like, and I know maybe you're not supposed to take stuff like that into account. Now, voters often do. Pedroia won the MVP award largely because it was funny that he hit fourth behind Ortiz in 2007 or whatever it was. And maybe that will help Altuve and that overcome the sort of the story of Aaron Judge becoming whatever the face of baseball or whatever people said, but I want Altuve to win it, not just because he's not a Yankee, but because I think he deserves it. The last thing I'll say, which is shocking and absurd, is that the third highest wins above replacement in the American League this year was Mike Trout, who only had 400 at bats. It's WAR is a counting stat, man. It gets higher than more at bats you have. He only had 400 at bats, and he's still basically he was on pace certainly for the best year that he had ever had. Which is saying something because he's the best player in baseball. It's just remarkable and really bums me out that he missed 6 weeks because I think the numbers he would have put up this year were, I mean, it would have been ridiculous to watch.
Oh yeah. I think it would have been his best season, which is insane to think about. And, you know, what a player. By the way, he lost the Silver Slugger for the first time. He lost it to George Springer, which is, you know, it's fine. George Springer is an amazing player, and we saw him in the postseason and whatever. Trout still should have won it. Yeah. Even missing 6 weeks of a year, yeah. Trout still should have won it. But again, the only thing I care about the Silver Slugger is that we get Joey Votto one. That's all. That's the only thing.
Maybe that will replace our Tommy Pham update next year. It'll be the Joey Votto still Silver Springer watch.
All right. So we have about 15 minutes to go with some listener questions.
Great.
Which is always one of our favorites. So we'll just start here. Evan wants to know, one current MLB player must bat for you. Okay. And he's giving us considerations. Strikeout equals eternal damnation.
Okay.
Any other out is destitution. Not spelled properly, Evan, but thank you. You have 280 characters. You can get it all in now, Evan. If he gets on base, you escape the situation, which I think is great. Okay. And a home run is you get one wish granted. So who is your pick?
So basically this question is saying, are you going for the home run or the best chance at a base hit?
Well, clearly you don't want the strikeout. So that is, right. I mean, the eternal damnation is the obvious. So
you're losing Aaron Judge. You're losing you're losing guys like Goldschmidt probably.
Right.
You're losing anybody who strikes out more than like 110 times a year.
Yeah,
it's funny because now the best hitters, you know, there used to be years when Tony Gwynn would strike out like 13 times.
Oh, yeah. We don't have any of those guys left.
There's no more of those guys. There's no more Yogi Berra who had more home runs than strikeouts.
Than strikeouts, exactly.
Wow. I don't know. I mean, Altuve's got to be considered. Charlie Blackman's got to be considered. You wrote a long piece about how he never hits into double plays, mostly because he mostly hits the ball in the air and never comes up in double play scenarios, which is interesting. So it's like the best combination of just don't make an out, right? I mean, it's Votto. Right, maybe it's Votto.
It could be Votto. Votto will strike out. He knocked his strikeouts down pretty significantly this year. I think that's where you have to start. So here are the top five in people who don't strike out per at bat. Joe Panic. You're not taking Joe Panic, right? No. Andrelton Simmons, who had a really excellent offensive year for him, but you're not taking him. Yuri Gurriel, you're certainly not taking him. Here's an interesting one. Jose Ramirez.
Huh.
Strikes out only one time in 8.5 at bat. So you're sort of working out eternal damnation. Plus, with two strikes, you're telling him, don't you strike out, right? I mean, you're giving him the don't you strike out because I'll be eternally damned if you do. So I think Jose Ramirez maybe or Altuve, you know, I mean, because the other guys, I mean, here's one I bet you might go for, actually. Number six on that list, one strikeout per 8.2 at bats, Justin Turner.
That's who I go with.
There you go. As soon as I saw that, I'm like, because the bigger the at bat, the more likely he is to just zone in.
He is a joy, an absolute joy to watch hit many reasons. And he never gives up an at bat. He never gives up a pitch. And his eye is fantastic. I'm going to go Justin Turner, but if he's unavailable, I'm rolling the dice and going with Stanton. Let's go, buddy.
That's awesome. D. Shama wants to know, who would have more success, Clayton Kershaw pitching righty or Altuve hitting lefty?
Oh, Altuve.
Altuve. That's not close. I think Altuve would be a fine left-handed hitter. I think he'd be perfectly fine.
There are people who can throw 97 with their regular hand who can't make the majors because they don't have enough movement or they don't have enough control. Like, you think anyone is going to be able to do anything with their offhand? Forget it.
It's a really good point. Rob wants to know, should you choose to spell the color gray, G-R-E-Y, or G-R-A-Y? I have a class full of students who are almost coming to blows.
I have a huge problem with this specific issue because I never know. One of them is like this sort of British spelling and one of them is the American spelling. I tend to lean E-Y, but I believe you shouldn't do that. I believe you should do A-Y, right?
I think AY is the, it looks it, better. AY looks better
I,
to me.
Yeah, I guess. But my instinct for some reason is always to go EY.
Well, it's the British in you.
I think the thing that's really crucial to remember here is it doesn't matter.
here's the thing, Rob. I assume you're a teacher based on this. Don't let your kids fight over this. Don't let that happen.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, it feels, just tell them AY and then just move on. Let's move on.
Tell them AY unless they prefer EY.
there's the answer. All right, Jeremy wants to know, how excited should we realistically be for Ohtani? Ohtani, the Japanese superstar player, pitcher, everything,
two-way guy. Home, he DHs, right, in his league, and he also pitches and lights out. He's 23, does everything. Yeah,
I'm super excited. Okay, I just can't tell you how excited. Of course I'm excited. I can't wait. And obviously there's still the stage where nobody really knows. There are negotiations going on. Nobody really even knows for sure that he's going to come over, although it looks pretty promising. Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait to see what this guy can do in the big leagues.
I totally am psyched. I'm 100% psyched. I'm a little bit skeptical because is he going to a National League team so he just can hit when he is pitching, right? Or is he going to American League team? And if he's going to American League team, is an American League team really going to have one of their, what a guy they hope is their ace, or at least a number two starter,
right,
going to risk injury to that guy having that guy hit every day? I'm more skeptical that the American league will allow him to do all of those things. Maybe they will, maybe he's that good, but I mean, there's a reason that pitchers don't hit very well, and it's because the teams don't want them to. They don't want them to spend a lot of time.
They don't want to focus at all on it. That's
right. Yeah, focus on it and then get hurt legging out a double and then miss five starts. They are valuable because they pitch 32 times a year or so.
I agree. But what I'm psyched to see is if he's a good enough hitter, they'll make it happen. You know what I mean? I mean, that's what I'm really psyched to see. I mean, we've seen very, very good hitting pitchers over the last few years. I mean, obviously, Bumgarner is a good hitting pitcher now, and then there are others. But we've never seen anybody where you're like, oh, let's tear it up and do whatever we have to do to get that guy in the lineup. It's always like, oh, I'm thrilled. You know, maybe I'll pinch hit him now and again. But this guy might be really a good hitter. I'm so excited. I cannot wait to see.
I mean, at the very least, you'd have to say it's new. Whatever's coming, it's a new thing.
Exactly.
That's exciting. Yeah.
Exactly. All right. Dan wants to know, what is the ideal candy to steal from your kids' buckets so that you enjoy it, but they don't notice right away?
What a great question.
It's a great question, Dan.
Ooh. I mean, you want to go with one that's common. Right.
Yes,
because that's the way kids are dumb. They won't count things. So, yeah, if there's 11 Snickers in there, you can take a Snickers and they'll never know.
That's exactly. My daughter had 17 Reese's cups this year, which was awesome. I've had six of them already. She doesn't know.
Yeah. The other thing you could say is that there's probably some candy that they are not familiar with that you might be familiar with, for example, a 100 Grand Bar or a Fifth Avenue or one of those sort of lesser known candies that they didn't register that they have it because they don't recognize it as a common thing. You could probably sneak one of those and they would probably forget one of the sort of lesser known.
Well, that's a good,
marginal candies. Yeah.
The thing is though, if there's only one of those in the thing, they might be like, hey, no, I want to know for myself how good that is. So I still think you go common. I think you go for whatever the most common thing is in there, because I think you're going to count on them not being candy accountants. I think that's your best bet.
Yeah, I think that's your safest bet, yeah.
D. Greenstone wants to know, what can listeners do to convince you to bring back one last meaningless thing? D, I'm afraid it's gone, man.
Yeah, it's gone. Sorry.
The only thing that I feel negative about it being gone, by the way, the reason it's gone is because we feel like we achieved perfect meaninglessness last week when I told everybody that I stepped on a rake and it bonked me in the head. Yep. So we felt like that we can't, we can't get more meaningless than that. That's pretty much the,
it's
the,
peak meaningless. Yeah.
It's peak meaningless. So I just, you know, we'll come up with something new. The only thing I feel bad about, well, the two things. One is that undoubtedly that's probably on my Wikipedia page now that I stepped on a rake and it bonked me. I can only assume. I'm not going to look, but I can only assume. But second thing is the music. That's really the loss here is the wonderful One Last Meaningless Thing song. So maybe we should just have him play that and then not do it. But at least that way they get the music, right?
Yeah, I also have a little bit of a question. If we had a guest on and that guest really wanted to say something meaningless, would we allow that guest? Would we make a one-time exception?
Yeah, we would. I think we would. I think we'd bring it back for guests who want to do that. By the way, something for our podcast listeners to look forward to. At some point, I don't know when, but at some point we are going to have Brandon McCarthy on here. He has requested to come on to do a draft of people in the We Are the World video.
That's right. Right?
That's right. So so that's something to look forward to. That's going to be pretty spectacular. All right, let's get let's look. I think we got time for three or four more questions here.
Let's do it.
Let's see. Oh, Kurt wants to know, and this is probably a thing more to you, favorite philosopher?
Oh, boy.
That's a big one for you right now.
Yeah. That's really hard. I really like this guy, Tim Scanlon, who's still around. He a modern philosopher who wrote this book called What We Owe to Each Other, which has sort of become the main text that we are basing certain aspects of this show, The Good Place, on. Sure. He's not easy. It's not easy to read. I say this for me at least. I'll speak personally. It's a little bit of a dense read. This book, but it is like it's really great. The ideas behind it are really wonderful. And then there's a woman named Philippa Foot who was a British philosopher in the 60s, yeah, who was the one who came up with this sort of famous trolley problem. Which you've probably heard about. You're driving a trolley and it's going to kill five people, and you can switch tracks and kill one person. And then there's like 400 different permutations of it. And it's a thought experiment that leads to a lot of really interesting discussions about like sort of consistency of behavior and about what's permissible and what isn't permissible. And I found her really fun to read too. So those are my two current faves right now.
Awesome. And the trolley problem plays a role in this year.
Yes, we did. That's right. The sixth or seventh episode, I can't remember now, of this season, the second season of The Good Place, which is available on Hulu.
Hulu, exactly. NBC.com,
I think, and which will be available on Netflix after the season ends in January or February. Yeah, we did a whole episode about the trolley problem, and other people have too. There have been it's a very famous thought experiment. It's very fun to.
Nobody asked me. I think that question was specific to you, but my favorite philosopher, Socrates. I'm just going Socrates. I'm going old school.
Classic choice, man.
The problem with Socrates is he's probably like the Bob Cousy of philosophy. Like also couldn't dribble with his left hand, you know? So
I got to say that like in my, I refer to it, commonly refer to it as a sort of Wikipedia level understanding of philosophy, but like,
sure,
it is fascinating to go back and read Aristotle and Plato and people like that.
It is.
Like,
no, it really is.
Those
That's
dudes
true.
Were so smart. They figured so much stuff out without the benefit of basically anything. Like they with no one had come before them to help them really. And if they had, they had written in languages that they weren't around in Greece at the time. And they just really, Aristotle especially, was just like the mind reels at how intelligent.
Oh, it's astonishing. Yeah. Although a lot of that Socrates, right? A lot of Aristotle, you know, he uses Socrates.
They all built on each other, certainly, yes. Yeah, but it's still fun.
It's impressive. It's impressive. Bill, we'll combine two questions. Bill asks, are Dodger dogs really the best ballpark hot dogs? And Jeff asks, what does Michael eat at a ball game now that he's a vegetarian?
So great we'll question. Just double it up.
Bill, I'm going to just tell you this, and I've just spent basically the entire month of October in LA, essentially, and had a lot of Dodger dogs. They're good dogs. I'm just going to flat tell you, I don't think they're the best dogs in baseball.
What are?
I think they're it's a tie. I just don't think, like when I had a Dodger dog, I'm like, oh man, a Dodger dog. And I'm like, this dog is not that different from the dog at Wrigley or the dog in.
Of course Cleveland not. They're all exactly the same. They're literally exactly the same. They are low quality hot dogs that you're spending $11 on. I mean, to me, it's like, it's funny because I think that Dodger dog, I think the alliteration really helps.
It does. It does. Terms of like they're good. They're long. I mean, they're long. They're impressive dogs.
They're ballpark hot dogs. They're all garbage. It's garbage food. It's fun to eat them because you're at a baseball game and that's what you're supposed to do. But none of them are good. I mean, I went to whatever the hell it's called, AT&T Park in San Francisco. What is it called now? What is it?
It's still AT&T.
AT&T. It changed. All of these. I thought it changed again. But anyway, the point is, the first time I went there, I went to get a hot dog, and this is 10, 12 years ago now, and I was walking on my way to get a hot dog, and I saw, because it's San Francisco, I saw this thing. It was like get this sausage. This gourmet sausage that has like cheese infused into the middle of it. Like they took a syringe and injected cheese into the middle of this sausage. And I was like, well, that's better. And I bought that and it was like the best. It was like good by restaurant standards. It was so amazing. Yeah. And it's like that. The only way to have a good baseball food experience is to do something like that. Like all of the hot dogs are exactly the same. They're just boiled garbage meat. that you buy for $8 and then you slather whatever combination of ketchup, mustard, and onions on them. Like there's no good or bad baseball hot dog. They're all the same.
It's a tie. It really is. And the best dog that, well, first of all, the best dog that in baseball is in Cleveland because they have the best mustard. So that's the best dog because of the mustard. But more to the point, the best dog is at your ballpark. Watching your team, right? I mean, they're all the same, so that's the best dog. So if you're a Dodger fan, yes, Dodger dogs are absolutely the best.
Correct. And to answer the second question, by the way, I eat peanuts. I eat a bag of peanuts every.
Yes, of course you do.
Every game, I will also eat popcorn with my son. My jerk son likes popcorn. and then if I am legitimately hungry, I will eat a vegetarian hot dog, which are not a tie with all hot. They're considerably worse than every ballpark hot dog.
Why would you do that to yourself? Because if
popcorn and peanuts isn't enough to sate my hunger, it's the only thing I can do. It's like you can get nachos, but that's not going to help either. If I actually need some kind of actual food item, I'll eat a vegetarian hot dog and they're disgusting.
Every now and again, my wife will bring home like some sort of vegetarian hamburger, right? Every now and again, for me to grill. She's like, let's try these, this way there's no red meat. It's better for you. So it's a soy burger or veggie burger, whatever these burgers are called. And every time I fall for it, because they look good, they look like the regular burgers. And every time I take one bite and go, oh yeah, I forgot. That's horrendous. That's just absolutely disgusting. So I don't really, at some point you ought to just look at the vegetarian hot dog and go, no, I know what that is. I've done that. That's not acceptable. All right. Last question belongs to Brody, and you want to talk about philosophical. Brody wants to know, how would your lives be different if you had been raised as Yankee fans? Better, worse, too terrifying an idea to even consider?
Do you want to go first? You want me to?
I have a very specific thought of what would have happened if I'd been raised a Yankee fan. Because this is something as soon as I saw this question, I immediately thought what would happen. I'd be a Yankee fan, okay? And I'd be happy because I'm a Yankee fan. The Yankees are good every year. And I'd be happy and people would be like, oh, I hate Yankee fans. And I'd be like, shut up. The Yankees are awesome. They're great. And I'd know that they're wrong and that the Yankees are awesome. And I'd be walking around with my Derek Jeter jersey or my Reggie jersey or whatever, Ron Guidry jersey. And I'd be super duper happy because the Yankees are good. And then when they stink, I'd be like, oh, the world's coming to an end. And then they're good again. And I'm like, this is awesome. And then one day I'd be in my place, my apartment, and my computer would tell me, follow the white rabbit. Okay. And then the door would knock, and then there'd be like these guys there, and there'd be a woman there, and she'd have a white rabbit tattoo on her back. Right. And I'd be like, oh, I got to follow them. So I would follow them, and I would end up meeting Morpheus,
right,
who would give me two pills to take. One as a Yankee fan, it goes back to just your regular mm-hmm. life. One as where you see the truth, and I would take the truth pill, and I would realize the horror that this world is.
Right, you would realize your whole life has been a lie, and
been a lie.
You had been seduced to believe that everything was fine, and in reality, right, your body was being used as like a giant battery in a weird alien
exactly.
robot.
Exactly, my life. A Yankee battery. My body had been would be used as a Yankee battery. I'd be literally the one powering Yankee Stadium.
Right.
So that's just how I think. I mean, I could be a little off on that, but that's sort of what I think would happen if I'd grown up.
Yeah, that's probably right. I mean, I was going to say my first thought was like my life would be worse because I would be a party to one of the great evil organizations of modern times. Like, you know, you don't want to ever consider what your life would be like if you had been like born into like the fascist black shirt part of Italy during World War II, right? Like that's too horrifying to think about.
It's horrifying to think
about. But I also would like to believe that we all, each of us, have inside us a kind of burning ember of pure good. And uh-huh. that in a way, if I had been born a Yankee fan, that, you know, I would have been like sort of, you know, obviously like co-opted and blinded by the fandom that surrounded me, but then that burning ember inside me would have started to sort of like, you know,
it would glow. It would start to
yes. glow. And yeah. that is at some point in my life, maybe after the Aaron Boone home run, or maybe maybe after like the A-Rod trade, or maybe after the even after like the 2009 series or something, that like at some point I would have on my own just sort of been like, you know what, this isn't right. This isn't right. This isn't just, and it's not right. Yeah. And I can't be a party to this anymore because ethically and morally, this just feels wrong. It feels wrong to root for this team. And I would have defected. And who knows what would have happened after that? I mean, I, you know, by that point I was out here in LA. I might have become a Dodger fan or an Angels fan or a Padres fan or something. And I might never have achieved the kind of happiness that would have come from being a Yankee fan or a Red Sox fan or anything. But I like to believe that even if that's true, that my life would have been better. And I would have looked back on that first, whatever, 35 years of my life with a sort of like a little bit of shame, obviously.
A little shame,
but also
sure,
a feeling
sure.
of like, well, I didn't choose this. Like I was just born into this and I'm happy. All I can do now is sort of start over. I can take this burning ember of good and use it to undo some of the wrongs that I was a part of while being a fan.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Would you feel like you would then preach?
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Yes. I think I would go on. I would do lectures, unpaid lectures, volunteer lectures in schools and churches and in community centers all across America, just saying like, look, you know, I got out and there is a path. Like if you feel like you are trapped, just know that you're not trapped. Like I got out, there is a way. And, you know, if I could help one other person stop being a Yankee fan, I would be worth it. Like, it would be like that happens. That's my path through life is to help other people like me who were born into something that they know isn't right.
They know yeah. deep inside. Yeah. They know.
They all know. I mean, some of them are just fine with it. In the same way that Joey Pantoliano's character in The Matrix was like, I know this isn't a steak. But I know it's not real, but I just want to eat it. So I'm going to like side with the robot.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm just going to side with it. By the way, what would Papa John's pizza have been like if it had been Yankee fans that made him the official pizza?
I mean, worse, right? Worse than Nazis.
We are not ending this podcast saying
Yankee fans are worse than Nazis.
The Nazis, I don't know, man. You're not worse than Nazis.
I mean, we were about to end it with me saying this is just like Joey Pantoliano's character in The Matrix eating steak, which is like just as weird.
It is just as weird. It is. I would say we didn't end it with meaningless things, but we did end it with weird.
Now, did we decide to replace one last meaningless thing with anything, or were we just sailing off into the
sunset? we were gonna do like a question, but I think we need to. We need to ponder.
Yeah.
We need to take
a sort of. There's no rush.
There is no rush. So let me figure this out. In fact, if listeners do want to send us ideas of how to end this thing, that is not meaningless thing. We're not going back.
No,
not sorry. The one thing the podcast stands for, it's moving forward, right?
No, I mean, no, not at all. It took us six years to get a microphone, but wait, let's, this is a good idea. Let's solicit, let's crowdsource this son of a gun here, and say send in your suggestions for what the very last thing that we do on the podcast should be. And the guideline should be like, it should take about a minute, right? It should
be very short, about a minute.
And it can't just be us saying something meaningless. It has to be something specifically different that we can each do. Well,
it will be us saying something meaningless.
Yeah, right. That can't be the announced name of the segment.
Exactly.
All right. So send in your maybe next time we do this, we'll specifically send out a solicitation for suggestions.
Exactly. But if you want to do it, just tweet us, and we will be considering how to end this thing. In the meantime, as always, Michael, thank you.
Thanks for having me.